Our reading is Psalm 139, and you'll find it on page 627. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake, and I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! O men of blood, depart from me! They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts. And see if there be any grievous way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting.
Thank you, Jeremy. So you should have a white sheet headed Hot Potato. So this is the first of a series of 3 weeks where we're looking at issues that as Christians we need to think through. And so we won't be going through a passage as is our usual practice, but instead we'll be looking at lots of different verses and what the Bible says about various topics. So today our topic is abortion. And if you want pens, I think they're circulating. Some 70 years have now passed since World War II, but the Holocaust still fills us with horror. Mass murder of 6 million Jews, a program of systematic state-sponsored murder by the Nazi regime, and we struggle to believe how it could have been allowed to happen. How on earth did the regime get away with it? Why didn't more people speak up and oppose it? They must have known that this was going on. Why didn't the churches take more of a stand? In 70 years' time, people will probably look back and ask the same question about our society. 1967 was a very good year for me. It was the year I was born. It was a very bad year for millions of others. It was the year the Abortion Act was passed. And since then, there have been 7 million abortions in the UK. And it's with good reason that one book on the subject has been called The Silent Holocaust. It's a very uncomfortable subject to tackle because all of us are implicated in some way. You may be someone who has had an abortion, one in three women by the age of 45. And whatever your reasons at the time, you'll be able to relate to the woman who testified, not a day goes by when I don't think about it. Or maybe you encourage someone to have an abortion, perhaps as the father or other family member, you put pressure on the woman. Or maybe you're a medic who has signed authorization papers for abortions. Or maybe you're someone who'd say, well, I would never do anything like that. I've not had any involvement at all in abortion. But what have you done? Because there is the guilt of having done nothing and just walking by on the other side. It's tempting to avoid the subject because in our different ways we all feel maybe condemned. But it's important we address it for the sake of the 7 million and for our own sake as well. Jesus did not come to condemn the world, but to save the world. And in the gospel, we find everything we need. Forgiveness for sin and guilt, hope for a better society, power to do what is right rather than what is convenient at the time, and a community to support us in hard times. We're going to start with the key question on the sheet there. So when a woman becomes pregnant, what is in her womb? And when you're in emotional turmoil and you've just learned about an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy, that is not the moment to be trying to work out your answer to this question. The Bible is clear that that human life begins at conception. So Genesis 4:1, and all the references are at the bottom, Genesis 4:1 says, "Now Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain." So Cain's life began at conception. Psalm 51 verse 5, David says, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." So his mother didn't just conceive a blob of tissue, she conceived me. Human life does not begin at birth, it begins at conception. Now actually that is no longer a controversial point to make. So in informed public debate, no one questions anymore the humanity of the human embryo. Medical science leaves absolutely no doubt about it. And so embryologists, the experts in the field, they are quite clear what fertilization represents. When a sperm penetrates the wall of a human egg, what you have from that point onwards is a new human being. So that single cell, called a zygote, is the first cell of the new human. So a unique individual with its own unique genetic code, combining the mother's and father's DNA in a new way. And all the genetic material required for full maturity of that new human is there in that single cell. So it has the ability to divide and to direct its own development until it is a fully grown human. And nothing is added from that moment on except oxygen and food and water. From the moment of conception, what follows is just the development of that individual through pregnancy and childhood to adulthood. And the development of this new human being in the womb is something we now see thanks to ultrasound technology. Even at just 8 weeks, all the child's limbs are clearly there, including fingers and fingerprints and toes. And at 12 weeks, it is fully formed and all the organs are beginning to function. It is not a potential human being, it is a human being with potential. A real living person in miniature. So in biological terms, we are dealing with a human being from the moment of fertilization. So the human embryo is a human being at an early stage of development. So the humanity of the child, that is no longer contested in informed debate. So the question is no longer whether or not we're dealing with a human being. We obviously are. The question nowadays is how we're going to treat them. Now that may strike you as odd. You may think, well, why would there be any confusion about how to treat an unborn human being? What has now happened is this, that people are trying to make a philosophical distinction between a human being and a person. So advocates of abortion are saying that you can be a human being without being a person. So personhood is not automatically given to a human being. It's what you get only when you can perform certain functions. So you only become a person when you can do certain things. When you say, well, what things? There's no consensus. In fact, once you claim that personhood begins at some point after fertilization, what point that is actually pretty arbitrary. So some people say you become a person at 14 days. Others say at implantation. Others at quickening. That's when the mother first becomes aware of the baby moving. Others say at sentience, which is the capacity to feel pain. Others at viability, so the ability to survive outside the womb. Others at birth. Or even, some say, at self-consciousness. And so you've got philosophers like a guy called Peter Singer who are arguing that only 28 days after birth does the child have a right to life. And during that time, parents should be allowed to decide whether or not they want to keep the baby. Now, all these points are significant stages in a baby's development, but that is all they are. After fertilization, it is just the next stage of development of that individual. It's not some point at which a human being becomes a person. The Bible makes no such distinction between a human being and a person. From conception onwards, what you have is a new person, someone made by God himself in his image and precious to him. And so in the verses we just had read, Psalm 139, did you pick up the continuity between the person writing as an adult, writing that psalm, and the person in the womb? Verse 13, for example, David writes, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret. Your eyes saw my unformed substance." So the I who praises God is the me who was being formed in the womb. It's the same person, just at different stages of development. Job says the same thing. Job 10, verse 8. He says to God, "Your hands fashioned me and made me. You clothed me with skin and flesh, and you knit me together with bones and sinews." That the unborn baby is a person, it's also apparent in that account of Mary and Elizabeth meeting in Luke's Gospel. So Luke 1:41, it says, "And when Elizabeth heard the greeting of Mary, the baby leapt in her womb." And then she says, "When the sound of your greeting came to my ears, the baby in my womb leapt for joy." Now that leaping in the womb, that was the response of the unborn John the Baptist in Elizabeth's womb on meeting Jesus for the first time, the unborn Jesus. And the word actually used in that passage for unborn baby, it's a Greek word, brephos, it is the same one used in the following chapter, in chapter 2, for a newborn baby. There's continuity. It's the same person at a different stage of development. So what is in the womb is a person whom God is forming and whom God is even relating to. So Isaiah 49, verse 1, says, "The Lord called me from the womb." And Jeremiah 1, verse 5, God says to Jeremiah, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you." And then that staggering verse that we had heading up the service, Psalm 71, verse 6, where the psalmist says to God, "Upon you I have leaned from before my birth." Now, what we're arguing for here is what every pregnant woman, I think, knows instinctively. She doesn't speak about her embryo, which is the technical term for what's in the womb from weeks 0 to 8. Or she doesn't speak about her fetus, that's week 8 onwards. She speaks about her unborn baby. It's personal. Now, you can see why this first question is so important. Because everything hangs on this. Once we're clear that from fertilization onwards, what you have is a new human being and a real person, it is not a difficult thing to work out how you should treat them. How should you treat an unborn child? Well, in the same way you would treat a child outside the womb. You see, whether inside or outside the womb, it makes no difference in moral status or value. The sixth commandment says, "You shall not murder." That is to say, human life is sacred to God. Every person is made in God's image. And although that image is marred by sin since the fall, Genesis 9 verse 6 says that because of this image of God, we are not to murder. But of course, in the Bible, our responsibility is not just negative. It's not just don't shed innocent blood. It's positive. We're to love our neighbour as ourselves. We're to love, we're to care for other people. And all the more so if someone is a member of your family, so your own flesh and blood. And all the more so on top of that if they are a dependent relative. It's very striking that in the Bible God has a special concern for the vulnerable. Deuteronomy 10:18 says, God executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Then in chapter 24, it says, you shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy. Isaiah 1:17 says, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, and plead the widow's cause. And then in Matthew 25, we're told, aren't we, to show hospitality to, the phrase is, the least of these. In all of those verses and passages, God has a special concern for the vulnerable in society. Well, no one is more vulnerable than an unborn child. Completely defenseless. How does God want us to treat the unborn? Well, they must be number one on God's list of those we should be showing special care to, loving them, protecting them, because they are so needy and so vulnerable. That is how we should be treating the unborn. How are we treating the unborn? Well, we're killing them, and in huge numbers. It's, in God's sight, mass murder. Now, using that sort of language is very emotive, but it's important to call a spade, because using euphemisms actually deceives people about what is actually going on. So if you speak about the termination of an embryo or the termination of a fetus, sounds very impersonal, very clinical, and sounds fairly reasonable maybe or acceptable. But once you start speaking about the murder of an unborn child, it brings home to you the horror of what is actually happening, and happening on a massive scale. 1 in 5 pregnancies worldwide, over 40 million a year around the world. Here in the UK, over 200,000 last year. 5 cyclists have been killed in London over the past 9 days on our streets, and it's front page news. But that many unborn children have been killed in this country in the past 15 minutes that I've been speaking. 547 unborn children every day. That's 1 every 3 minutes. And abortion now accounts for over 1 in 4 human deaths in Britain. So 27%. There are 2 types of abortion. Firstly, there's medical abortion, so using the drug mifepristone, or RU486, as it's also known, in combination with misoprostol. And basically what it does is it disrupts the development of the child and it initiates labour. Secondly, and more commonly, you have surgical abortion. The most common procedure is one in which the child is basically sucked out using a high-powered vacuum. Another method involves crushing and removing the baby piece by piece. And in 1974, there was a documentary called The Silent Scream, which enabled us to see that sort of abortion on ultrasound for the first time from the point of view of the victim. Now, image quality has come on a long way since then. And it's one reason why many abortion workers are turning pro-life. For one abortion clinic director, he was actually seeing the image of a 13-week-old that haunted her and made her change sides. She commented, it wasn't just tissue, just cells. There was a human baby fighting for life, a battle that was lost in the blink of an eye. For late-term abortions, there's even something called partial birth abortion, and I think I'll probably spare you the details of that one. But the point is not let's do this in a more humane way. The point is let's stop this altogether. It's important also to recognise that some forms of contraception are abortive. The point of contraception is, as the name suggests, to prevent conception. And so barrier methods such as condoms, diaphragm, or the calendar method, it does just that. It prevents conception. But once the egg is fertilized, any action that prevents that egg from implanting in the wall of the womb is an abortion. So the IUD, the intrauterine device, it does just that. It makes the womb incapable of supporting the life of the child. And RU486, known also as the morning after pill, it does just that. Its primary function is to prevent the child implanting in the wall of the womb. And even the pill, in some cases, the pill can be abortive. And I put at the back on the table there a sheet that I'd love you to take away, which gives you a lot more detail about contraception. I think it's really important to know more about that. Now, all of this begs the question, why on earth are we treating unborn children like this? I mean, it seems so obviously wrong once you recognize that an embryo or a fetus is a person. Well, various arguments are used by those who are pro-choice. I put them on your sheet. Some people say, well, a woman has the right to do what she wants with her own body. But since when does a woman's body have two beating hearts and two blood types and two heads and four arms, four legs? The unborn child is a distinct, genetically unique person. And so having an abortion is not like having a tooth extracted or your appendix taken out. Some say a woman has the right to choose. And legally she does, and the father has no right legally to oppose her. In fact, in the US, a guy called John Weldon, he gave his girlfriend, who was 6 weeks pregnant, an abortion pill, telling her it was antibiotics. And he's now been found guilty of murdering his unborn child. So there's clearly no confusion there about the status of the embryo. So legally, the woman does have the right to choose. But God would say, yes, you do have the right to choose, but before conception, if we just leave rape aside for a moment. Once conception has happened, you have a child with its own rights, and you have a mum and dad with responsibilities and moral obligations. So just as a mother of a 12-year-old does not have the right to kill him, however difficult he may be, neither does the mother of a 12-week-old. Some say, well, if abortion were illegal, there'd just be backstreet abortions, and that'd be more dangerous for the mothers. But that doesn't justify legalizing something which is morally wrong. Why not legalize theft? I mean, theft can be pretty dangerous. You could get injured breaking into someone's house to nick their stereo. Why not make it legal so you could just walk through someone's front door? And anyway, studies actually show that illegal abortion is not linked with an increase in maternal mortality. Some say, well, abortion is safer than childbirth. Actually, studies show that childbirth may well be safer. But even if childbirth were more dangerous, that is not a reason for killing the child. I mean, parents are expected, aren't they, to perform acts of self-sacrifice for their children. It kind of comes with the territory of being a parent. Well, those are just some of the pro-choice arguments. What about the law? What are the legal conditions for having an abortion? And we're over the page on your sheet. Abortion was illegal in this country until 1929. In 1929, the Infant Life Act made an exception in cases where the mother's life was in danger. And that exception carried over into the 1967 Abortion Act. Now, such circumstances are extremely rare. So an example of a life-threatening condition for the mother would be an early ectopic pregnancy or severe eclampsia, high blood pressure. Now, to give you an idea of how rare that is, abortion is still illegal in Northern Ireland, except where the mother's life is in danger, and the abortion rate there is about 40 per annum. 40 per annum, that's all. Even when the mother's health or life is in serious danger during the pregnancy, if it's late in the pregnancy and the baby's old enough to survive outside the womb, you can always have an early delivery through inducing labour or having a C-section. And much maternal illness can actually be treated during the pregnancy with no ill effects to the child, even having chemotherapy for cancer. Now, when the mother's life is in danger, why is abortion justified? It is not that the mother's life is worth more than the baby's life. Morally speaking, that's not true. It isn't. The point is simply this, that if the mother dies because she is carrying the child in the womb dies as well. You lose both of them. An abortion at least allows you to save the life of one. So that's one category, grave threats to the woman's life or health. And that is the only one, it seems to me, which is ethically, morally justified. But the 67 Abortion Act introduced two more categories. But that something is legal does not mean it is right, morally speaking. In the 1950s, a drug was developed for treating morning sickness called thalidomide. And it was subsequently found to cause severe birth defects if taken during pregnancy. And over 10,000 children were born with abnormalities, so especially stunted limb growth. And there was a lot of public sympathy for the women who had been affected by this. And as a result, another category appeared in the Abortion Act. And it made abortion legal in cases of severe physical or mental abnormality. Now, that was a massive change. The chances of abnormality are 1 in 30. And the chances of serious physical or intellectual disability are 1 in 50. But exactly what constitutes serious disability, that isn't defined in the Act. And so you have babies aborted because they have a cleft palate or cleft lip or club foot. And 90% of those diagnosed with Down syndrome are aborted. In practice, the medical recommendation seems to be to abort any child who has something wrong. Now, isn't that a desperately sad reflection on our society? And how very much at odds with what God says he wants in the Bible. It's very striking when you read passages like in Acts 3. You read about a man who is lame from birth was being carried. Or in John 9, verse 1, it says there was a man blind from birth. What does that tell you? Well, it tells us that among the Jews, babies born with severe disabilities were allowed to live. And by contrast, in the Greco-Roman world, abortion and infanticide were widespread. The Jewish attitude to disability was rooted in a biblical understanding of life, that each child is a gift from God to its parents, and each person has dignity because they're made in the image of God, not because they have certain abilities. I love that passage in Luke 14, where Jesus says, when you give a feast, he says, invite the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame, and you'll be blessed. And he says, that is what the kingdom is like. Now, in the end, of course, the reality is that all of us are disabled. Far more serious than any physical disability, mental disability. The real imperfection is the sinful, unloving heart that each of us carries inside. It's striking that even some of those who are resolutely pro-choice are against abortion for disability. Let me quote to you one Harvard feminist. She said, it is one thing to abort when we don't want to be pregnant. It is quite another to want a baby, but to decide to abort this particular fetus we're carrying in hopes of coming up with a better one next time. Now, of course, it's a huge thing for a parent to find out that their unborn child has a serious disability. But the last thing a parent needs in that situation is somebody offering them a supposed quick-fix abortion. What they need is support. They need help. They need to be able to talk to people who have experience of disability. They need to know that even if they feel they couldn't cope themselves with bringing up the child, they can give up the child for adoption. Sometimes people say, don't they, that abortion is compassionate because they don't want the child to suffer. But is the life of someone with disability, is it so unbearable that they're better off dead? Countless people with disability would say otherwise. And who are we to make that sort of judgment? Is it that we don't want them to suffer, or is it that we don't want to suffer because of them? Even in the most severe cases where the baby is going to die, we need to love and care and protect, not kill. Peter Saunders heads up the Christian Medical Fellowship, and he's written online 20 reasons why you shouldn't abort, even in the case of anencephaly, which is where a baby is missing most of its brain and will die within hours or days of birth. And the key question he says, and this is really important, he says, what is a baby with anencephaly? Well, he says it's a human being with a severe disability, and so should be treated like any other disabled person of any age. And of course, you could get similar brain dysfunction as an adult if you have a stroke or if you have a brain tumour. And the responsibility of your loved ones in that situation is to love you and care for you, not to kill you. A baby with anencephaly is a deeply dependent relative who is going to die. And any person in that situation deserves love and deserves care. But these two categories, danger to the woman's life and serious disability, they account for only about 2% of abortions in the UK. What the 67 Abortion Act did was it introduced a third category, which is that of the woman's mental health. And this accounts for 98% of abortions in the UK. Basically, what it does is it allows an abortion if continuing with the pregnancy would involve a greater risk of injury to the mental health of the pregnant woman than if the pregnancy were terminated. Now, there was actually an official report in 2011 which showed there is no evidence to support this. So there is no evidence that continuing with a pregnancy poses a greater risk to a pregnant woman's health, mental health, than an abortion. And Peter Saunders says that now means that 98% of abortions in the UK are technically illegal. And of course, what this category hides is the enormous distress and grief that comes from having an abortion. Even if continuing with the pregnancy did pose a greater risk to the mental health of the woman, you still have a moral responsibility for your child, don't you? In many ways, having and bringing up a child, it is harder than not having one. You know, sleep deprivation and financial cost and worry does affect your mental health. But which parent would say that because their child has made their life harder, they have the right to kill it? Even in the extreme case of rape, personally, I think there is no moral justification for abortion. Pregnancy through rape is extremely rare, but when it does happen, the child who's been conceived through this terrible, this wicked act, that child has got the same moral significance as any other child. And yes, the mother was terribly wronged, but her wronging the child isn't going to put right the way that she was abused. In studies, none of the women who continued with the pregnancy following rape, none of them regretted their choice. But somebody in that situation obviously needs a massive amount of support, practically, emotionally, and spiritually. In practice, this category of mental health of the woman, it has opened the floodgates to abortion for any and every reason. So this pregnancy could jeopardize my future, or I couldn't cope, or I couldn't afford a baby, or it'd get in the way of my work or my life plans, or even it would mean cancelling my skiing holiday that I had booked. Recently, the Crown Prosecution Service didn't take action against two doctors who sought to authorise abortion on the grounds of sex selection last year. That was in this country. And the CPS also didn't take action against doctors at 14 NHS trusts who had pre-signed abortion authorisation forms without seeing the woman. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you that basically it's abortion on demand. One every 3 minutes. Now, how should we respond? Three things I put on this sheet there. Firstly, we need to take a principled stand. God's word tells us to speak up for the helpless and to defend their cause. The law is unjust and immoral, and we need to lobby to get it changed. Now, even if that means initially just reducing the limit from 24 weeks, at least that will save some babies. But we need to be working and praying for the goal of abortion being made illegal again. as it is in Northern Ireland, except when the mother's life is in danger. And we should take heart from Wilberforce. Campaigning against the slave trade seemed completely hopeless, didn't it? But he persevered, and the slave trade and then slavery itself was abolished. And we need to pray for Christians who work in medicine, that they would take a stand as the Hebrew midwives took a stand in Exodus. Do you remember how they refused to bow to the secular authorities who had ordered the killing of the baby boys? Secondly, we need to give practical help. If many women are choosing abortion because of lack of support, then being pro-life means more than being anti-abortion. We need to help those who are facing an unwanted pregnancy, to educate them about the options, to give them counselling and support. The church should be a place where such women find the love and the practical help they need to carry on. And especially a single mother where the father has just fled his responsibilities. You see, a problem that seems to be overwhelming for an individual, it can often be eased significantly by sharing it with a loving community. In cases where the mother is unable to cope, what a difference it could make if Christians were queuing up to adopt unwanted babies. It's very striking that the early church was at the forefront of caring for abandoned babies in a society which practiced infanticide. As Mother Teresa once said, "We are fighting abortion by adoption." Moses was adopted, Esther was adopted, so of course was Jesus. And so are all of us as Christians, spiritually speaking. In India, they have a cradle scheme where newborns can be left anonymously at the Red Cross. In Austria, a woman can give birth in hospital in secret so that the baby can be offered for adoption. And in the same country, a woman can even leave her baby at a hospital for adoption. And there are similar what are called baby Moses laws in many of the US states, where you can surrender your baby to a safe haven whilst remaining anonymous and without fear of prosecution for abandoning your child. Now, what all those things are doing, they're providing realistic, practical alternatives to abortion. Why not here in this country? But lastly, gospel hope. As I said at the beginning, all of us in our different ways will feel condemned by a subject like this. Perhaps you've had an abortion, and not a day goes by that you don't feel the guilt and the grief of that. Perhaps you encourage someone to have an abortion. Perhaps you're someone who signed the forms. Perhaps your guilt is from doing nothing and from just walking by on the other side. All of us in our different ways may feel guilty. But in the gospel there is forgiveness from God for the sinner who turns from their wrong to Christ. Jesus said that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations. And so when we face up to our wrong and we come to Christ, we find forgiveness and we find healing. We find acceptance and welcome. We find power to carry on. And we find community to support and hope for the future. And so in the quiet now, let us, as Hebrews 4 says, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Let's take a minute to do that now in the quiet. And then when the music starts, we're going to stand, we're going to sing a song which is really a song of confession, not just personal confession, but confession for our country and acknowledging our corporate guilt as a nation in this.